sight. Caterpillar to a butterfly.
It's Green and Growing with Ashley Frasca.
Plants, flowers, trees, and stuff.
On 95.5 WSB.
Happy Saturday morning, everybody. Maybe you've noticed I am away today, but you're getting ready to hear some of my favorite calls over the last couple of weeks. And as I've advertised, this month is my Outdoor Expert Series. So that's going to continue with my guest at the bottom of the hour, Jim Bearden, the Bluebird Guy. We're going to talk a little bit about birding, but overall, just attracting bluebirds to your landscape. But first, I want to talk to Sherry. She's been patiently holding from Roswell. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question about diseases in trees and if they can transfer to shrubs. I had a beautiful ornamental peach tree for years in this little natural area I have where it's a lot of fill dirt, but lots of other little plants within two, 3 feet of it. The trunk, I don't remember what the disease was now, but it had like a sappy, gunky weepiness started, and the tree didn't last long after that. I waited about a year or so. I planted a different kind of ornamental tree, and that one did not last a year. Now, today, it's been about a year since that last tree died. Yesterday, I got a beautiful paper bush shrub.
Yeah.
I'm afraid to plant it. Do I need to dig out the dirt where that tree was? I'm assuming the disease, whatever it is in the soil.
Now, that's a really good question. So the oozy stuff that you described on that first tree, had anybody ever diagnosed it as maybe slime flux? Had you done any research on what that might have been?
I did at the time, but it's been several years and I really do not remember what it was.
Okay, because some trees will present slime flux, and it is. It's like a oozing, weepy kind of blah that grows out of the bark. That's a bacteria, and it will result in the death of the tree generally over time, maybe 1 to 2 years. But when we're thinking about soil-borne diseases and soil-borne pathogens that may be passed from one plant to the other, the good thing is that is so preventable, and it can be easily done with things that we're able to control. So we study, you know, with the University of Georgia College of Ag and the Master Gardener Program, the disease triangle. And you have to have three things for that disease to be present in a tree, a plant, whatever. Part of the disease triangle, you have to have the environment. You have to have the pathogen if it's present in the soil or present wherever. And the host plant, the plants that are most likely that it's going to attack. If it was something like Phytophthora root rot is a great example, Sherry, that's going to, you know, start to really wilt a plant. You'll see just decay over time, yellowing of the leaves, things like that. That's a good example of something that is a soil-borne pathogen. It lives in the soil and it rots the roots, hence the name. All those things have to be present. So generally, like something like that could be prevented by taking away one of those things in the triangle. So that's something you can control as far as the environment, keeping it a little bit drier, you know, not having the soil stay so wet. Or even if you're planting a new tree or a new shrub, mounding it up just a little bit and then getting really good cultivated plants from nurseries and things like that, really good rootstock that are maybe less susceptible to different pathogens and things like that. But in your case, it was hard to tell what the disease may have been. But if it was slime flux from one tree to the other, that generally could have just been a bacteria. It also could have been maybe that the tree wasn't planted right. If something was planted a little too deeply and the trunk doesn't get to breathe and some of those upper roots aren't close enough to the top of the soil to get oxygen, that could have been the cause for the decline. But now that you have a paper bush, Edgeworthia, which I love, you know, and those can get really big too. That can be a focal point in the landscape. Those can get 5-6 feet tall. I would think that you're safe to do it.
Okay.
Yeah. And if there was any doubt whatsoever, maybe that it was a root rot, like once something just, you know, when the roots just rot away and you're able just to yank up a tree or yank up a shrub and it comes literally right out of the ground with no hesitation at all, you know, the roots haven't taken very well, all of it's dead, that could have been a good indication that that's what those died from. So in that case, keeping the soil dry, not killing the new plant. Of course, it needs consistent moisture to really help establish roots when you put that Edgeworthia in there, but just making sure it doesn't stay saturated and you elevate it above ground just, you know, slightly to where water doesn't pool at the base of the plant. Always mulching around it too, because that can help control the moisture, keep unwanted bugs away, you know, keep weeds away so that that plant isn't competing with weeds for the nutrients in the soil, the moisture in the soil and all of that. And you're off to a good start.
Okay, great.
Long answer for your really good question, but I feel that that was important to talk to folks really about that disease triangle and how all three things have to be present, and we can easily control just one of the three, and then bam, you're not going to have a disease.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sherry. That was a great question. Thank you so much for the call. The one thing that I can think of that you wouldn't want to plant the same thing back is if you've had rose rosette. If you've had rose rosette on your roses, and knockouts are a little more susceptible just because they're so common and overplanted that they're in rows, they're close to one another, so it's easy for that mite, who is the vector of the virus, to just go from bush to bush to bush because they're all so close to one another. So that would be the only thing, rose rosette, that I could think that you would not want to put any type of rose whatsoever back into that soil, even if you just dig all that soil out and try to remove it and put new soil in that spot. I just don't think that's good enough. So there's got to be some other plant that we could sell you on, Daphne odora or, you know, peony or something else, dahlias that you might want to consider putting in place of a rose. But that would be the one thing I wouldn't put back. And again, in order for that rose rosette, even though that's a virus, in order to for that to be successful in destroying a plant, again, that disease triangle, all three things have to be present. So in that case, the host plant, if you put a rose back in there, you're introducing the host plant and you already have, you know, the environment for it. The mites have already been in the area. They've affected the roots and the soil and the pathogen. All of that's already there. So again, you take out one of those things of the triangle, the host plant, and you're going to be fine if you plant something else that that virus isn't going to attack.
Okay, enough from me. Up next, he's been holding patiently as well, Tommy from Decatur. Good morning, Tommy.
Good morning, Ashley.
What's going on?
Just called to talk about cousin seed pods and actually mimosa seed pods.
Okay. Mimosa's cool. Kudzu, not so much.
Well, the trees, the mimosa trees, those are so invasive, though.
Yeah. I know, but I love the smell. I love the pink little furry flowers, but they are really invasive. You're right. We got to stay on top of them.
Yeah. But yeah, the kudzu pods are on the ground right now, and, you know, along with the maintenance you were talking about with the broadleaf weeds, it'd be a good time to pick them up because they're starting to crack, open up, and drop the seeds everywhere.
Yeah.
It's something to look out for.
It really feels that now is a really good time to start to get ahead of some things. And we may even see some weeds popping up now because we've had sustained temperatures in the 60s. And then goodness knows, you know, what's going to happen with the cycle in a few weeks if it gets colder again. But those, have you ever seen a kudzu seed? They're pretty hard. So it's hard to know how long they stay in the soil and if and when they're going to germinate, but they're tough little seeds.
Right. You've seen the pods, though, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, they're pretty easy to identify. I mean, I've shown them to a lot of people, you know, in the area, and most, you know, even like some of the, you know, county people that work here and stuff, and they had no idea what it was. You know, most people, a lot of people aren't even aware that kudzu drops seeds like that.
Yeah, and the fact that it flowers, I mean, the flower's actually pretty decent, maybe flowers like over summertime and early fall, but when you're looking at just this vast down an embankment or something, it's hard to identify those flowers. And same goes for English ivy, too. That's a cool little spiky-looking white flower if you ever see it.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Well, that's good. And so what's your advice for the broadleaf weeds?
Broadleaf weeds, I mean, if you've got a broadleaf weed killer that you can spray in there, that's a good deal, or a little paintbrush with some Roundup if it's some small areas.
My man, Tommy, I love it. Well, hey, thanks for checking in. So good to hear from you this morning.
Take care.
All right, I hope to hear from you again soon. Great advice. I love Tommy's always got some good stuff. And I thought it was interesting through the Alabama Cooperative Extension, a little bit of history on kudzu. In the late 19th century, kudzu seeds were imported and sold for use as an ornamental vine, and it was used to shade people's porches and courtyards. Boy, if we knew then what we know now. It was also appreciated for the grape-like fragrance of its flowers, which the flowers are pretty. Again, it flowers out maybe late summertime. And by the turn of the century, kudzu was available through mail-order catalogs. Can you imagine ordering kudzu? Like, why in the world? But it was inexpensive forage for livestock, too. And then in the 1930s, kudzu reached the height of its prominence. The Soil Erosion Service, it's been renamed since then, was in charge to reduce soil erosion. And so they suggested that and gave kudzu plants to farmers. Like, that makes you want to pull out your hair, right? So that's how a lot of it got here. And here it is. It has taken over the South. And not that I'm promoting this by any means, but if you Google kudzu seeds, there's bags for sale. there's bags of kudzu seeds for sale. Like,
that's insane. Don't do that. All right, time to break. Coming back with the top three things to do this weekend and a question about fragrant lilies next on WSB. The update on the weekend weather brought to you by Finley Roofing. We have time for another call, and our outdoor expert series continues for this month of March. But first, this.
Green and growing. Ashley Fraska's top three things to do this weekend.
All right, all three of these good for the middle of March. Number one, fertilize tall fescue during its season of rapid growth, which is from the fall into the early spring. Apply fertilizer up to 3 times a year, so that would be right now, and then not again until September and November. And keep it mowed, too. That'll keep some of the weed pressure down. Number two, it's not too late to cut tattered monkey grass or liriope, however you say it. A mower set to its highest setting is the best to use for larger areas. There's a video on my Facebook page of me just down on my hands and knees with a small patch of the mailbox and just cutting that by hand. Use sharp hand pruners for those smaller plantings. I promise it'll go by fast. You don't have to be meticulous. And number three, plant roses. Pick a spot where they'll receive at least 6 hours of sun a day, ideally more though, and break up the dirt really well. Don't plant roses in an area where plants in the past have died of rose rosette. We just talked about that, right? Up next, I think the last call of the show so far, a great question about fragrant lilies and when to plant them. It's Ron. Good morning, Ron.
I'm thinking about planting some crinum lilies. I don't know whether you've had experience with them or not, but...
What kind of lily?
C-R-I-N-U-M.
Oh, yes, those are beautiful. Right, right.
But I don't know how whether to plant them now or not. It's too early, or when I get them, how deep to plant them, or how far apart.
All of that is going to be on the bag and the package, and it's so important to follow that, because that way you know you're planting at the right depth and all that kind of thing, and you want to really follow those. The good thing about bulbs is they don't really have to go as deep as you would think, right? Do know that lilies, if you've got animals and dogs that roam around the yard and whatever, they're highly toxic, but the crinum lilies are absolutely beautiful. And the good thing about bulbs, perennial, right? They're going to come back year after year after year. So I would go ahead, make sure they get full sun, but a little bit of partial shade is okay. Well-draining soil when you put them in, you know, that's really key so that the bulbs don't rot. Gosh,
that
I mean,
makes about half and half of Miracle-Gro.
You don't need to. If the soil's good, you don't need to put any fertilizer in the hole when you plant them. I would just let them get established and let them get used to the native soil, and I think that's going to be fine. What you want to do when they start to fade, like, you know, our lily foliage is going to start to really dwindle and yellow and all that at the end of summer, you always want to leave all of those leaves above ground. You don't want to trim them. You don't want to cut that foliage back, because the longer that stays above ground, it's taking in all the sunlight and all the energy to put back in the bulb. And then that way, when the bulb stays in the ground all fall, all winter, it's like charging up like a battery because of all that sunlight that the leaves got. So the longer you leave the leaves, but then when they really start to yellow and brown, if they look ugly, you can cut them back. But that's kind of its own fertilizer, the way that it's just recharged after getting, you know, sunlight for months and months and months. That way it can perform at its best the following spring and summer.
As you said that, because a friend of mine was looking at my ginger lilies, and she said, you should cut those leaves back. I said, well, I think the leaves help to enrich the plant when they, you know, that was before winter. I just let them die back and left the leaves on. But I'm having trouble finding fragrant lilies. I love fragrant plants, but I got ginger lilies, and Walter said the crinum lilies were real fragrant, so that's why I'm anxious to get them in the ground.
That's a good one to go for. Yep, you're absolutely right. Yeah, a ginger lily is beautiful. They get tall. They kind of remind me of a shorter version of a canna lily. They get tall, but that white flower just smells so great. So yeah, Ron, if you can get your hands on some, go ahead and get them in the ground.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. I love my ginger lilies.
Oh, I do too. I can't wait. Now, I still have the tattered foliage of mine, the hollow brown stems up near the fence, because I thought, okay, well, some cool little bee or some little insect's going to like to overwinter in those. But once I cut them back and those little nodes, you know, the little pink nodes are coming up from the ground, I'm like, yes, they're ready. That and the hostas are going to start to peek out soon. The canna lilies, as I mentioned. So great question, Ron. A good observation. See, it's always good to be told you were right. You were right, right?
And hey, this morning, if you've missed any of the show, any of the guests and the big topics we've covered, feel free to go back to wsbradio.com/greenandgrowing. Listen to the podcast there and follow the Facebook page. Just search Facebook for Green and Growing WSB. There you'll find my photo albums too, Weed of the Week, Highway Horticulture, all to help you identify things you're seeing now. Time to take a break, and then the last half hour of the show coming fast on WSB.
Oh yeah, the grass is green.
I'm gonna live.
always greener on the other side. Caterpillar to a butterfly.
It's Green and Growing with Ashley Frasca.
Plants, flowers, trees, and stuff.
On 95.5 WSB.
Almost through the show already. Can you believe it? Just after 8:30 on a Saturday morning. So glad you have spent time with me here on Green and Growing this morning. Hopefully you've learned a thing or two. My gosh, I know you have. And if you haven't, you're getting ready to for sure now from one of my friends right now. I have billed him as part of my outdoor expert series here in the month of March, Jim Bearden, the Bluebird Guy over in West Cobb County. Hey, Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Ashley.
I love coming back to you for conversations about bluebirds. You were one of the first field trips that I took when I started the show 4 years ago. You had me out to Green Meadows Preserve. We had a wonderful afternoon. I know you still do great work there. You were actually one of their volunteers of the year back in 2020. So some accolades for the hard work you do there. Introduce folks, though, to Green Meadows Preserve. What is that?
Well, Green Meadows is a 112-acre park in West Cobb. That's a passive park. It's got meadows and walking trails and community garden. We have a Cherokee garden there. We have a couple of beehives and beekeepers that look after those. We have the Bluebird Trail that I started 13 years ago. So it consists of 31 nest boxes scattered throughout the 112 acres along the trails and in the open fields. And it has 10 feed stations where we supplement their insect diet with dried mealworms.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, but you have constructed all 31 of those bluebird nest boxes and then some for people around the Atlanta community, right?
I have. I built and put those up at Green Meadows. I've done them at other Master Gardener Project parks and gardens. I would say I have put up over 500 of these in the state of Georgia.
I believe it. I believe it. And I've seen your work. Now, tell folks how a bluebird house is a little bit different than just a standard birdhouse.
Well, the houses that I use, I buy from a woodworker that builds them for me. Bluebird nest boxes, these are made of untreated cedar, western cedar, and they age really well in the elements, the hot summer sun and the winter climate. I do not paint them, let them grow natural, and the birds seem to appreciate that. But the bluebird nest box is a little bit deeper, and the hole in the box that they enter is an inch and a half because bluebirds don't want it any larger, or you get bigger birds in, or any smaller than they can't fit through the hole. So different birds like different size holes that they enter and exit through the nest boxes. Bluebirds are particular about how high they like it, which direction it faces. Over the years, you just learn a lot about their habits and their wishes and what they do best with. I always put them about 6 feet high, always in the open spaces so that they're not under any tree cover or squirrels can't jump on them to destroy the cedar. I always face them east. They get the morning sun after a cool night, and then we get less rain and wind out of the east than the other directions.
Now, I'm starting to see a few couples in my backyard, two or three couples kind of milling around, and I've got a bluebird box as well back there. It seems to me that they're kind of starting to think about, you know, shopping for real estate, building a nest. Is this nesting season, and what materials do they use?
The nesting season for our region is mid-March through mid-August. They start looking for condos in February if the weather's not too severe. I just finished checking all the boxes at Green Meadows this week, and we have partial nests and we have some full nests, but no eggs yet. I know certain other regions I follow on Facebook that, for example, in Texas Bluebird Society, they already have eggs in their nests. So if pine straw is available, that is their material of preference. Like out in the open field at Green Meadows, we have a lot of grass that they just cut in February. They cut the fields once a year. So they have a lot of fresh cut grass to choose from. So if the grass is more available than the pine straw, out in the field they'll use grass. But everywhere else they use pine straw.
Now, speaking to Jim Bearden, the bluebird guy who has that wonderful bluebird trail along Green Meadows Preserve in West Cobb County. How can we tell if it's an intruder, if it's something else building a nest in there?
You can always tell the species of bird pretty much by the material they use to build their nests. If you get a nest box filled with sticks and then a little tunnel made down to the bottom, that's going to be a wren, a house wren. So they just fill the box full of sticks, and it's hard to check them because they go so deep in the box to lay their eggs. If you open the box and you see nice green moss with some little bit of grass or hair on top of it, then you have a Carolina chickadee.
Hmm.
So they all are cavity nesters, just like the nuthatches are cavity nesters. But they like the hole to be only an inch. Inch and a half is too big for them, so they choose to find a hole in a tree or a fence post or something different, unless you put a box up for the nuthatch. Hmm. You can always tell pretty much by the material they use to build their nest without even seeing the bird.
And I remember, Jim, during our time together walking through Green Meadows Preserve, you had a funny way of, you know, describing how they mate. And so explain kind of the process there, how they pair up. But the ones we see together, do they mate for life? Are they always coupled like the way I see them in my backyard?
They're very family oriented. You'll see large groups of bluebirds in the off nesting season. And that's usually the offsprings from years gone by, because they hang out together as a family and they help each other during nesting season with feeding and supporting the new family. They usually find their mates early in the year, January, February. They get serious about housekeeping towards the mid or end of February. And then once they decide on the location that they want, they get pretty aggressive. You'll see them hanging out there, just kind of laying claim to it.
Yeah.
Not doing any nest building yet, but just checking it out, going in and out of it. I get a lot of calls or emails or texts about, are they building a nest already? And usually I tell them it's a little bit too early. So they're just laying claim to the house. And then once they decide this is the location, it's the male's job to find the house. And, of course, he can't move in until she says it's okay. Pretty much like life. So once they do, then when they start building the nest, they're both busy building the nest. She's the one that does the interior decorating because she's got to make it fit her body, and she's the one that's going to lay the eggs and incubate the eggs. So he's busy bringing her material, and she's placing it inside the box and forming the mold that fits her. Takes about a week to build a nest. Once they build the nest, she takes a break. Their diet is primarily insects, a lot of moths, a lot of caterpillars. She goes out and finds food. And once she starts to decide she's going to start laying eggs, she lays one egg a day up to the number she's going to lay. That could be from 3 to 5. Sometimes we have 6, but I've never had more than 6. When she lays those, again, she goes get some exercise or flies around. Because once she starts incubating those eggs, mm-hmm. she's pretty well confined to a lot more time of sitting on them. She doesn't sit them on the eggs 24/7. She just knows how long she has to sit on them to keep them warm enough, incubate them to hatch.
And Jim, we've got a couple more minutes here. You mentioned they're insect eaters, which I love. You know, let's encourage folks to not use insecticides just because, if you really don't have to, or make sure you're at least targeting the specific pest on the specific plant where there's a problem. But they love coming to my feeder too, along with the other birds. They'll eat the no mess blend, the peanut mix that I have from Wild Birds Unlimited. But what else do they like to snack on if we can provide something supplemental?
I supplement their food with dried mealworms. You can use live mealworms, which I started out when I had one nest box. But then the volume gets so large, it's hard to maintain live because you have to keep them in the refrigerator. And my wife got tired of opening the refrigerator downstairs and seeing live mealworms.
Right.
So I went to dry, which they like just as much, because the dried mealworms is a great source of protein. And it gives them known food if they can't find the insects that they like. It's proven that it's helped with the number of eggs they lay, the number of eggs that hatch, and the number of babies that fledge, because it's a good source of protein to help them have bigger litters.
Well, Jim, you've got an event coming up next weekend that folks can participate in and meet you, and then a way that they can help coming up this summer. Tell us quickly about it.
We do walk and talks out at the park on Saturday morning, the 23rd of March. We have our first of the year, and it's from 10 to 12. We meet at the classroom behind the Bullard House, the White House. We talk about bluebirds and talk about the park. Then we do a mile walk through the park, and you can see some of the boxes. And if I know there's nests in them, I might open them. If I know there's eggs, we'll open them and take a look with a mirror. So you get a chance to see firsthand what's going on during the nesting season. We do a fundraiser every year to help offset some of our costs. I spend about $200 a month on mealworms, so this is a good way to get back, get some money to help offset some of those costs. So we normally have it at the Marietta Wine Market. Seemed to have done better in the summer than it did in the fall. So I'll be getting that date out, or as soon as I set the date, I'll put out a message to save the date and more information to come.
And you know I'll pass it along to the listeners. Well, Jim Bearden, my friend, the Bluebird Guy, thank you so much. What a fun conversation. I hope we get folks excited about birding. If they aren't already, those are easy to spot in the landscape. Thank you, Jim.
All right. Thank you, Ashley.
Coming right back with the top three things to do in the landscape this weekend, it's 95.5 WSB. The update on the weekend weather brought to you by Finley Roofing.
Green and growing. Ashley Fraska's top three things to do this weekend.
All right, as promised, we'll get to an extensive list of things that you can be pruning now in just a moment. But number one, how about it's the time to fertilize tall fescue during its season of rapid growth. Always fertilize things when they are in active growth. Otherwise, that plant is not uptaking those nutrients. So for fescue, you know it's happiest between fall and early spring. You can apply fertilizer up to 3 times a year. Now would be the last application, and then not again until September and November. And remember to keep fescue mowed regularly, about once a week, or maybe a little more often if it's growing vigorously. That's going to help with weed pressure. It's going to help choke out weeds if you keep them at bay, and don't let them go to seed. That way they spread and become more. Number two, it's not too late to cut tattered monkey grass, lirio, liriope, however you say it. But a mower set to its highest setting, probably best to use for larger areas, or sharp hand pruners for smaller plantings, which is what I've done. A very simple short video on my Facebook page. Search Facebook for Green and Growing WSB. It may be kind of boring, but you get the picture. Number three, plant roses. Pick a spot where they'll receive at least 6 hours of sun a day. Ideally, a little bit more, though. Break up the dirt really well. Don't plant them too deeply. And do not plant roses in an area where plants in the past have died of rose rosette. You need to be aware of that, or your landscaper. Let them know the history in that spot. Okay, so for things to cut now, well, one of them was monkey grass. We just talked about that. Roses. I've gotten messages from a lot of you worried that you've missed the window for cutting maybe knockouts back. You haven't. I always try to do it around Valentine's Day. This year, I failed to do that. Yes, there's new growth on them, but cut them back to 10, 12 inches high. You're not going to hurt them. They're still going to have a flush of new growth all spring and summer. Panicle hydrangeas, the ones that are cone-shaped, that are like a grape, bunch grape shape, those are going to bloom in the summer on new wood. They've been bare and kind of leggy all winter long. You can cut those limbs back. Camellias that have finished blooming. You know, the japonicas are so pretty in the wintertime, and they're dropping petals like crazy. So you want to maybe cut those back to shape them. Forsythia is almost done. That makes me sad. That bright yellow flowering shrub, which is so pretty. Quince, winter honeysuckle, once their shows are over. Boxwoods, you can go to town with those. Make sure you don't have boxwood blight, though. If you do, that's a whole nother story. And hollies as well. And if you need help with pruning some of the bigger things, like shrubs, whether they're flowering or not, Walter Reeves published the Georgia Gardener published a pruning calendar years ago in the Atlanta Journal and Constitution, still has it on his website. It's a grid. It's very, very simple to follow what months to prune a certain thing and which not to prune. So go to walterreeves.com and in the search bar type pruning calendar, and that's going to be really fun for you to look at. All right, some of the websites to cover some of the guests that you heard from today. My thanks to all of them who participated in this show and allowed me to have a Saturday off. We talked about Landscape Pro University. If you want to get involved in professional organizations or continuing credits for the profession that you're in, go to UrbanAgCouncil.com to get started there. Dr. Alan Armitage with a new book coming out on cut flowers. Find out more at alanarmitage.net. Danny with Via Citrus. Check out some of the products that you can try growing outside, but then indoors in the wintertime here, viacitrus.com. And go to my website for details, again, on the Bluebird Trail Walk with Jim Bearden, professional workshops just like Landscape Pro University, webinars, seminars, and classes about gardening, all of that there at wsbradio.com/greenandgrowing. It's been a great Saturday morning. Have a blessed weekend, and I'll be back with you next Saturday.